Tim Russert's doctors knew he had coronary heart disease and were treating him for it. Here's his cardiologist, Dr. Michael Newman, interviewed after Russert's death on Friday.
Tim had coronary artery disease. He had no symptoms, asymptomatic coronary artery disease, as we see in many men and women. His risk factors were well managed. He was well informed. He did his best with respect to diet, exercise, lifestyle. His blood pressure was well controlled. His cholesterol fractions were optimal. He had a stress test April 29th, got to a very high level of exercise, and he was quite pleased with his performance, as we were this morning.
So why did Tim Russert have a fatal heart attack on Friday? And what do we know about preventing and treating heart disease today? Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 10 minutes past 6 o'clock on this Wednesday, June the 18th. And during this hour, on the day of Tim Russert's funeral, we will talk about a concern that many of us have upon learning of Russert's sudden death. He was only 58 years old. He was being treated for his heart disease. He was doing what he could to lower his risk. How much of a risk are we at for a heart attack? We will talk with a guest physician and welcome your questions for him about heart disease and controlling or preventing or treating heart disease. 1-800-642-1234, toll free from anywhere. If you're in Madison, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Our guest is Dr. John Keevil. He's an associate professor of medicine and co-director of the Cardiac CAT Scan Program at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. He joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning.
So help us understand what happened to Tim Russert. He was being treated for his heart disease, supposedly had it under control, yet look what happened.
Yeah, I think this is it's an example and a very public example of sort of the unfortunate process of heart disease, in that we can simply reduce risk, but we can never bring it down to zero. And it does sound from the description of his physicians that he was doing a number of things, although there are descriptions also that he wasn't at optimal levels of things like all his cholesterol features. But what happens is we bring risk down lower, and then there's always a few people who still can have bad events and still have trouble.
Yeah. Talk about the reports that his cholesterol levels were not optimum.
Well, I don't have the numbers at all directly, but I've seen somewhat conflicting reports, one that his LDL cholesterol may have been treated well, others that his triglycerides and HDL, what we sometimes describe as the good cholesterol, healthier particles that have cholesterol in them, were not at optimal levels, and that's sort of the secondary layer. Again, I don't have the initial information,
right,
but that's actually a fairly common feature for many of us.
Talk some about why he would have a stress test at the end of April showing normal heart function and then have this happen less than a month and a half later.
Yeah, the stress test, I would agree, was reassuring. I think the data suggests that somebody who does very well on a stress test then is at low risk for the next year or so. And by low risk, we often describe less than 1% problem in the next year or the next chunk of years. But there's still then 1 in 100 chance that you could have trouble. What a stress test looks for is interruption or limitation of blood flow at peak exercise. And so he was able to exercise strongly, and his arteries at that moment were open enough to allow blood flow through well. What can happen, unfortunately, in coronary disease is the disease process itself can act a little more like an earthquake or a volcano, kind of intermittent eruption or intermittent problem. So a plaque in the artery that lets blood flow through well on one day can suddenly change, and it can crack, and the body can start clotting and block that artery very significantly in very short periods of time.
Yeah, that from the reading I've done on this, it sounded as though his artery, that left artery where a lot of the cholesterol was fairly open, but it blocked when the artery wall ruptured and the cholesterol leaked into the artery.
Exactly. Yeah, the heart disease can develop very substantially. You can have large volumes of heart disease, but the body does some smart sort of balancing things. The wall of the artery can get very thickened with heart disease, but the outside edge of the wall can actually stretch out and get larger, and so it sort of makes room for the heart disease that's in the wall, and the inside of the artery can still stay big enough to function well. But then you can have a large pocket of this heart disease, this cholesterol, inflammatory elements, and that pocket can crack and rupture, and blood can get in there and start clotting and cause very acute problems.
How long does that take? I know it probably is, it depends, but I mean, I'm wondering, is this an immediate massive heart attack in a matter of minutes when this crack occurs, or does it happen over time that it clots?
Well, it's much more on the immediate side of the realm. Often it can be just minutes. And this is the issue here is that the body has some very effective systems for blocking arteries, and it has these systems developed to keep us from bleeding to death. If we get a very bad cut, then the body does a whole bunch of things to block that cut off very quickly, and so that's a skill that the body has in a way. And the problem is when the inside lining of the artery cracks, the blood cells don't know the difference between your body bleeding to death and needing to block this problem up and causing a problem by blocking the artery that you need for your heart. And so that's why it can happen so quickly, because our body has these systems that are able to move very fast because they're sometimes needed.
Our guest is Dr. John Keevil. He is an associate professor of medicine and co-director of the cardiac CAT scan program at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. We'll talk more about assessing your own risk for a heart attack coming up after we check the weather. And we'll welcome your questions, too, about preventing and treating heart disease. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 18 and a half minutes past 6 o'clock on this Wednesday, June the 18th. I'm Joy Cardine. Happy to have you with us. Hope you stay tuned. Coming up this afternoon, Ben Marins is with you between 4 and 6 for At Issue with Ben Marins. After 5 o'clock this afternoon, as so many become increasingly busy, it's become more difficult to focus and to connect in our personal and professional lives. After 5, Ben and his guest will talk about a key to judgment and perception, attention. Talking about attention after 5 o'clock this afternoon. We're talking about heart disease, preventing and treating heart disease, and what we know about heart disease, and welcoming your questions in light of Tim Russert's sudden death on Friday. Tim Russert, 58, dies of a massive heart attack on Friday, raising a lot of questions about what we know about heart disease and how we might prevent it. 1-800-642-1234 is our toll-free number, and we do have an open line for you. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Today, Tim Russert is laid to rest. It is his funeral today, but he is continuing to help us learn, not about politics today, but about our hearts. And we welcome your thoughts and questions. Our guest is Dr. John Keevil, who is with the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. He also developed the Heart Risk Assessment website, heartdecision.org. Tell us about that website, Dr. Keevil. What's that all about?
Well, this has been sort of a fun, labor of love, if you will, project for me. This has started back when I was in training, began thinking about this pretty actively about 12, 14 years ago. And what caught my attention is that there are some ways to predict risk of heart disease, and the most common use of this is from the Framingham study, which was a study that has been going on now for over 60 years in Framingham, Massachusetts, where physicians have just watched a population of people very carefully and learned as that population grows up and has heart disease what the signals are and what the predictors are for those that develop a heart event, you know, heart attack or death or not. So using that in 2001, the cholesterol guideline, the cholesterol treatment guideline that's used by physicians all over the country and the world, took that Framingham score into the guideline and then used that to help develop recommendations as to who would get therapies that would be appropriate for cholesterol or for, you know, aspirin and those kinds of therapies. And it's a fairly complicated process, and so I felt it would be appropriate to try to build that into some sort of a computer system. And so I started with a little palm-top computer years ago, and then I had an Excel spreadsheet that I would hand out to people, and then this website is kind of the latest evolution of that, where it's something that I use and just, you know, other colleagues of mine use, and it helps me kind of get a handle of, when you put all these different risk factors together, what is what are the best recommendations for someone's therapies and targets for cholesterol.
And what are the risk factors in general?
In general, there are six or seven sort of traditional high-level risk factors, and these orient around the decision of whether or not to treat the, what we sometimes call bad cholesterol, the LDL cholesterol particle. They are age, and age is probably the biggest single number that drives risk. Sex, men have about a 10-year head start or so on women for heart disease, although both genders get it. Tobacco use is one of the most powerful, potentially modifiable. Some people have a tremendous difficulty stopping smoking, but it is a modifiable risk factor. Hypertension, and then changes in the cholesterol pattern, whether or not we have diabetes, and then somewhat less powerful but still sort of in the mix risk factors are obesity, other blood tests that can be checked, and then a strong one is family history, so just a signal of what your siblings or parents or even children are, you know, what events they're having as well.
Yeah, and I mean, in terms of if people have all those various risk factors, and what do you do to determine if someone indeed has heart disease, has maybe this plaque in the wall of their arteries?
It's a difficult and complicated question, because I think what we know from population studies that have been done more recently is that in the United States, the vast majority of people, as they get older, have some evidence of heart disease. We have atherosclerosis. There is some very early evidence of atherosclerotic disease in a very large proportion of our teenagers and of our 20-year-olds.
Yikes.
And this is the very early stages of these plaques and this disease process that gets going. And so I think we get into this mode of not really if we have it or not, but sort of how significantly we have it, and then what's the chances that it'll cause us trouble. My goal for, you know, the country is that, you know, we're not going to probably get rid of the heart disease process completely, but we are trying hard to get rid of as many of the bad events as possible. So a heart attack like Mr. Russert had, or other events that develop chest pain and other troubles. That way, it may be that we can have at least some disease in there, but we can suppress the number of events or problems that gives us.
We'll talk some more about treatments and such in a moment, but we have some callers. Joy in Madison is with us first. Hi, Joy. You're on the air.
Thanks. Good morning. I'm wondering, can you explain, they used to talk about...
I'm sorry. I guess we lost Joy. Well, that's great. Let me try to paraphrase her question. I think she was interested in eating rich food, and maybe talk a little bit about fatty foods and the obesity factor.
Yeah, and the obesity factor, interestingly, is if you look purely at obesity, just weight, and try to link that with heart disease, that's been variable. And if you, and the issue is, if you take away all the other, you know, statistically take away things like hypertension and cholesterol that go along with obesity, it's hard to make a very powerful mathematical argument that obesity is linked. But we know so powerfully that obesity is linked to these other intermediate issues. It's much more common to have diabetes if you're obese, and it's much more common to have abnormal cholesterol levels and hypertension and to be inactive. And so the obesity itself gets us into many of the other risk factors that are a problem.
You know, Dr. Newman, Russert's doctor, I guess he's not a cardiologist, he's an internist, but he says that if there's one number that's a predictor of mortality, it's waist circumference, and that studies have found that a waist over 40 inches in men and 35 inches in women is a risk factor for the heart disease. And he did say that Tim Russert, of course, was struggling with his weight.
Yeah, I think many of us struggle with our weight, and it's a funny issue about sort of perception and normalcy. If you look at Wisconsin as a good example, we are just big. You know, we are large people, and we are fat people on average.
Speak for yourself, Dr. Kivo.
Well, this is data. We actually, in a previous survey of the whole country, we were number one for obesity. I think that's shifted to maybe Louisiana recently, but the whole country is you know, cranking upwards as far as weight goes, and it's just not healthy, but it is become kind of the norm. You know, it's become expected to sit down at a restaurant and be given, you know, 2 to 3 times what we really should be eating, and that's considered a good quality meal because it's large.
Yeah, you know, Tim Russert was traveling in Rome before this. I mean, if you're, you know, if you go off the wagon of your treatment and you're, you know, you're eating and drinking a lot, and I mean, does that exasperate it? Could that have contributed to the sudden heart attack?
Well, I think it's a blend of what you're doing sort of throughout your whole life. This heart disease, the plaques in the arteries take decades to develop. So there's this sort of slow component to it of how you're treating your body every day on a day-to-day basis. There is then things that can tip you over. So if you have plaques developed already, if you have a sudden stress, if you have some other challenge to the system, you can sometimes trigger the specific plaque rupture or crack or change that would trigger a heart attack. And sometimes we look specifically at those triggers, but they tend to always come in the context of significant disease. And so it's really under treatments, it's really that underlying disease that we're working toward.
We only have a minute before a news break, but I know another one of Joy's questions was whether his long plane ride back from Rome could have had anything to do with this deep vein thrombosis?
It's my understanding that at his autopsy, that was not considered a problem.
Mm-hmm.
One of the other things that can kill people suddenly is a clot in the legs that goes quickly to the lungs. The deep veins in the legs or pelvis can create clots that go to the lungs, and that can kill people suddenly. But I don't think that was his specific issue.
We're going to check news from National Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Radio, and then more questions for Dr. John Kivel, who is an associate professor of medicine and co-director of the cardiac CAT scan program at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health, talking with us today about preventing and treating heart disease in light of Tim Russert's death. This is the Ideas Network. We are talking about preventing and treating heart disease this hour with Dr. John Kivel. Following the death on Friday of Tim Russert, NBC's Meet the Press moderator, he died of a massive heart attack at the age of 58 on Friday. His funeral today, taking the very sad opportunity to learn more about heart disease during this hour and welcoming your questions for our guest physician, 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Please include your first name and your community with your email. Our next caller for Dr. Kivel is Steve in Rice Lake. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi. Hey, I was wondering if the doctor could comment on up north here, you know, we in the local newspapers, we have these advertisements for these, like, whole body scans or your carotid artery scans. I was wondering if you could comment on the effectiveness of those and a little bit about what you see on TV, you know, some of the scandals with the dyes that are used. And then I was wondering if he had a comment about if you find plaque, is there anything, I mean, once you have plaque, do you have it always? Or can you, is it treatable or, you know, something of that nature? And then the other thing is on chest pain for, you know, men and women both. I mean, they say women don't experience chest pain as much as men do, but if you have chest pain, does that automatically mean, you know, you're having a heart problem, or is some chest pain common? Or I just wonder if you could comment and I'll take my answers off the air.
Boy, I hope I wrote down all of those. I might have missed the middle one. Did you get them all?
I scribbled some down as well, so okay. I think we can give them all a good shot. Steve, these are all great questions, and they come up, you know, for all sorts of people, and I think he's hit a lot of questions that folks have. Let me just try to take them in order. I think there's as you know, when you watch television, there is you know, there's care, and there's taking care of people, and there's making them healthier, and there's the sort of healthcare business, and then there's the real business of healthcare in the industry. And so I think there are tests, and there are things out there that are very useful and helpful for people, and there's also sort of versions of tests whose, you know, primary issue is to sort of make money. I think in general the whole body scans drift a little more toward the latter, unfortunately. But at the same time, the types of things that are being scanned and those kinds of tests do have a role. In particular, we have two types of studies that we do at UW. The one is the carotid artery scan. This is done by ultrasound, so there's no dyes and no radiation. And this has been developed very effectively by my colleague Jim Stein. And this gets to the question and the issue that I spoke of before, that many of us have disease, but how much do we have and how well do we fit in for our age? So one of the best uses of this is somebody with a very high family history or has some disease, and we're trying to make a decision of whether to treat it more aggressively, and we can look at their carotid arteries and see if they are thicker than what we would expect, say, for a 55-year-old woman. And so I think in very focused places, these scans have great utility. So that's sort of a short answer there.
All right. Then he said if you discover this stuff in your artery walls, is there anything
right
you can do to get rid of it?
So what if you have plaque? And there is absolutely lots of things that can be done. This is why I'm so optimistic about the world of preventive cardiology right now, is that there's been a number of studies recently where if you look closely at a plaque, either in the carotid artery or inside the heart with a special ultrasound wire, you can measure that level of plaque. You can put people on very aggressive medication therapies and come back a year, 5 years, sometime later, look again. And on average, we have seen studies that show regression of these plaques. It actually stops moving or backs up a bit. And I think that issue in and of itself is very exciting. So, yes, if we have some plaque, we are likely to continue to have at least some, but we can greatly improve the risk of that plaque. We can probably pull back the amount that we have, and we can substantially reduce the chance that it will turn into something bad, that it will rupture and cause a heart
and
attack.
And that's done like through statins, through other treatments like that?
Yep. The basic set of treatments are blood pressure therapies, and there's a whole variety of those, cholesterol therapies, and statins are the most sort of talked about and most known and most proven to reduce risk, but there's a series of other ways to optimize the cholesterol pattern. And then the lifestyle changes that a lot of us need to make, which is essentially eating less and exercising more and shifting the body to a healthier status. And those different tools are useful. And the final piece is quitting smoking, if anybody's smoking out there. The final little piece is the chest pain question, I think, that Steve had is, you know, I sometimes sort of partially joke, but there's probably 40 things in the chest that can hurt.
Right.
And so, of course, not all of them are coronary artery disease. We worry on the acute setting about three major chest pain problems that can hurt people quickly. One is heart disease, which could be causing angina. One was mentioned earlier, the deep vein thrombosis. It could be a PE, a pulmonary embolism. And the third would be the aorta itself tearing or rupturing. And far and away the most common of those three is coronary artery disease, and that's why we have so much effort directed at that. If we analyze for those three issues and none of those are present, then we can sort of relax a bit and not worry about addressing it right that day. But
yeah, and it's true that sometimes, though, women don't present with chest pain when they're having a heart attack?
It is true, mm-hmm. and I think it's true for both men mm-hmm. and women. In the Framingham study, again, about 50% of the events that women had came forth without the traditional sort of crushing chest pain going out to the left arm. However, you know, half of them did, so there's mm-hmm. there's this balance. And I think that issue is largely just that standard description was originally described in men, because men were the ones who were largely parts of the early studies. And so if women had gone first, then it would be men that were atypical, probably. But yes, other symptoms such as dyspnea, meaning shortness mm-hmm. of breath with activity, a change in your ability to exercise. You now walk up a flight of stairs or walk for half a mile, and it's much more difficult now than it was last month. Nausea, sweats when you're active, those kinds of things can add to the likelihood that it might be a cardiac
yeah,
problem.
I know a very close colleague here at Wisconsin Public Radio, her symptom was she was tired. Very,
yeah.
very tired. And we heard that some colleagues thought Tim Russert looked tired on that morning. Is that exhaustion? Is that a symptom that a heart attack might be impending?
Well, as you can imagine, in this high-energy, limited sleep world, a lot of us are tired.
Mm-hmm.
But I, too, have had many patients that feel very tired, and that's a component of what turns out to be heart disease. Again, mm-hmm. you know, only a small portion of it, I think, is that's the main feature. But if your body is hurting, you know, if your heart is getting limited oxygen, then the body will generate a lot of adrenaline and there'll be a lot of stress on the body. And I think for some people that then can manifest as significant fatigue. Again, one of the many ways that this can present.
We're going to check weather, and then I promise more calls and questions for Dr. John Keevil, who is with the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health, developer of the Heart Risk Assessment website, heartdecision.org, talking with us about preventing and treating heart disease following the death of Tim Russert by a heart attack on Friday. 1-800-642-1234, an open line for you. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up after 7 o'clock, I'll talk with two guests about the current Senate investigation into harsh interrogation techniques that were used by the U.S. military on prisoners in Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo and elsewhere. Critics, of course, call this torture. Senate trying to figure out who authorized these techniques, and we'll talk about that coming up after 7 o'clock. Right now, talking about preventing and treating heart disease with Dr. John Keevil, and our next caller is Anna in Madison. Hi, Anna, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I had two questions. First of all, I was wondering about a diagnosis of angina. And I was wondering if that in and of itself means heart disease. And my second question is about HDL. I have an HDL of 99, which I've been told is above normal but is not clinically significant. And I'm wondering, what does this mean for me? Since I have a total cholesterol under 200, which I think is the upper guideline, I'm wondering, do I have extra leeway there with my LDL and my VLDL?
Oh, does that mean your LDL is 101?
No, it means it's pretty low. It's, let's see, it was about, my total cholesterol was about 180, mm-hmm. I think, last it was checked. And I've forgotten the breakdown.
No, yeah, so you don't know what your good cholesterol is.
My good cholesterol is 99.
Oh, okay. Good cholesterol is 99. Yeah. And then do you know what the triglycerides were approximately?
I don't.
Sure. Yeah. But they can't be very big if the total is down that level.
No, I remember it being on the low end.
Sure.
Oh, yeah, I see. The HDL is the good cholesterol, and that of 99, that is very good, isn't it?
Well, it probably is. And you bring up an interesting issue that we've been addressing recently at UW. In rare cases, probably, the HDL cholesterol can get too large. And in general, and to say this for the overarching issue, HDL is, you know, cholesterol is not good or bad. It's the particles that it's running in. So if to say more accurately, the cholesterol that's running in the HDL particles, being carried in the HDL particles, represents a healthier scenario. HDL, the low end, we want it to be over is at least 40 for usually for men, 45 for women, and generally the higher the better. As it gets over 60, we consider it sort of a negative risk factor, that it actually reduces risk. Probably there's an upper limit, and my colleagues and I think sometimes around HDL of 100 or so, there is going to be a small number of people that actually have somewhat dysfunctional HDL.
Oh, I see.
So I hate to make you worry at all, but it is possible that the HDL is sort of overpacked with cholesterol and is not able to pull cholesterol out of the wall, is what we're thinking about. And this relates to the drug torcetrapib, which had been tried out by Pfizer company and had been studied. It actually dramatically raised the HDL cholesterol, but it did it in such a way that likely made the HDL cholesterol particles less functional, and people didn't do better. They actually did worse on that drug, so that drug was stopped. So it raises a couple issues, and in general, high HDL is better. High HDL reduces risk, and represents a low risk state. In a situation like this, this would be a scenario where, given the other risk factors, given the other situations in the family, one of these tests, like a carotid evaluation or a CT scan for calcium, one of those other sorts of ways of getting at it, would be appropriate. The total number of people with HDL this high is quite small, actually.
Yeah, and what about I always called it angina, but
sure. And I think it's described both ways, or it's pronounced both ways. The angina, if you've been given the diagnosis of angina, then that implies that the person using that phrase thinks it is heart disease. So by definition, angina suggests chest pain coming from the heart and coming from limited blood flow to the heart. So it may be that diagnosis is not correct, if it is correct, then that implies that the coronary arteries in some way are to blame. Either they have limited blood flow capacity, or they have a tendency to tighten up, which happens for some people and some women.
I wanted to ask you, doctor, about a column I read in Prevention Magazine, the July issue. It had to do with cholesterol, and the doctor in that column was suggesting that we ask our doctors for a lipoprotein subfraction test, which divides your cholesterol into subparticles based on their size and density, talking about the big particles versus small particles that are more or less likely to lodge in your artery.
Sure. As we said at the beginning, because heart disease is so prevalent, we're working hard to try to find other ways to figure out, are people at risk. It is true that one of the suggestions is that if you think about these cholesterol elements as little particles coming around in the body, the cholesterol is in the center, and then they're wrapped around with proteins and different little markers, and that's what defines the HDL and LDL particles. If you have a fixed amount of cholesterol in all of the LDL particles, we sometimes call this the bad cholesterol, but it's the same cholesterol as everywhere, that number, that amount of cholesterol can be carried around in a small number of very large particles or a larger number of small particles. And we don't always know which is which, who has the small particles, who has the large. The reason it might matter is that the small particles do tend to get into the wall of the artery a little more easily, and they tend to get stuck there because they get modified, they get oxidized and glycated, and they get stuck in the wall and add to plaques. This, I think, should be considered sort of a subtle modification of the cholesterol issue. And a very simple way of guessing that this might be an issue is if the triglycerides are high. And if the triglycerides are above 150, and this is the threshold target we use for everybody, then that condition actually drives the body towards these little particles.
Mm.
So in many cases, we can guess accurately whether the particles are going to be small or not just by looking at the triglycerides. And if we lower the triglycerides, then the particle size and density can improve.
Yeah. Another test question from Ruth in Green Bay. Will the heart calcium scoring test detect early signs of heart disease? Do you know about that?
Yeah, and that's a test that can be done by cardiac CT scan. Calcium is very easy to see on CT because it's so much harder than everything else in the heart. And this is a test that's used relatively frequently. Here in Madison, the culture has been not to use that currently, but I think the data is getting stronger and stronger for it. This, like the carotid test, is a test to sort of see where someone's arteries are compared to their, you know, their colleagues or others of their age. And it can identify the amount of calcium in the arteries. Calcium represents atherosclerosis or heart disease that's been around for a while. If you have an inflamed area, one of the things that the body does is put calcium down in it. And so this works as sort of a useful marker for disease that's been there for some time. And now, Tim Russert actually had a calcium score by my reports. He had a calcium score measured in 1998, so 10 years ago, when I presume he was 48 years old. That score was listed as 210, which at the time, back then, we didn't know a lot about. It represented an increased risk, and I'm not sure how concerned people were with that. It does represent he had some coronary disease. Now the data would teach us that for 48-year-old men in America, white men, a score of 210, only 4% of the country is worse than that. You're at the 96th percentile.
Mm-hmm.
So at that point 10 years ago, there was a flag. We understand that flag better now, but there was a flag back then that there were very few people that were at higher levels of atherosclerosis than him.
Andy in La Crosse is with us now. Hi, Andy.
Yes, good morning.
Morning. Morning.
Very short background. Before diagnosis, I got like two packs of cigarettes a day, half a gallon of coffee, I don't know, a ton of salt and 2 tons of fat. Been diagnosed with in need of quadruple bypass. And I got kind of scared, and I said to myself, I can undo myself what I did 50 years, and I don't know if it's possible or not. I went to zero animal product, nothing fried for like more than a year.
Mm-hmm.
The only supplements I'm taking is like Argenics and Therapeptiles.
Yeah, and we had a bad connection, Andy, but I think we got that. He had he had bypass surgery, and then he went on a strict low-fat, no-fat diet, apparently, and is better now, Dr. Keevil. How important is diet?
And I think diet is very important. It's one of those pieces that gets a little less play because, as you can imagine, no company is making specific money off of it, but it is critically important as it leads to lots of other layers. It works in concert with the medications, and it will help reduce cholesterol and reduce blood pressure. And if we can shift ourselves to healthier fats and just eat less, generally, then that will improve risk. I think anybody who's had bypass surgery automatically is at the very highest risk for further events and has to go through all of these issues. You have to go back and look at, you know, obviously he was smoking cigarettes, that have to stop. You have to make dietary changes. But then it's very important to know what the blood pressure is, to know what the cholesterol is, and look at those very critically and use a combination of medications and diet and exercise shifts to drop that cholesterol.
Yeah, can diet itself unclog the artery?
Well, I think in some very extreme cases, Dean Ornish was one who developed very extreme diets. In some of those cases, it does look like the arterial walls may back up just a little bit. But in other studies with people that are at quite high risk, it's been very difficult for diet alone to do it. Now, that said, you know, this disease is not an either-or process. It's a multi-risk factor process. And if we improve all of the risks, then we improve We drop the risk further and further for each change we make. And so they all work together.
Only have a minute left. I wish we had more time. But one thing we didn't talk about is the stress. A lot of people think that, you know, Tim Russert was under a lot of stress. All of us have a lot of stress. Does that play a part?
It probably does, but it's hard to know how much of that is different than the risks we know. If you're under a lot of stress, you have a lot of catecholamines or adrenaline in your body, most likely. Your blood pressure will probably ride high.
Mm-hmm.
People eat less well when they're under stress. People sleep less well and then sometimes eat more because of that. And so I think a stressful life blocks your ability to really take care of yourself well. And it probably also pushes up these things we know about, such as hypertension and other risk factors.
Well, we are out of time. I hope you'll come back sometime and talk with us again. Thank you very much.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Dr. John Keevil, Associate Professor of Medicine and Co-Director of the Cardiac CAT Scan Program at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. You can check out his heart risk assessment website, heartdecision.org. Thanks to Rob Ferret, Karen Prager, and Cynthia Schuster for producing this program. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.